Episode 131 of Futures Radio Show, sponsored by CME Group, the world's leading and most diverse futures and options exchange. CME Group's markets help individuals and businesses around the world manage risk and seize opportunities. Learn more at futuresfundamentals.com.
Every day, traders and investors dive in to tackle the ever-changing markets to find opportunity. Futures Radio Show is your number one source for answers to the questions that all market participants want to ask. Veteran futures trader Anthony Crudele sits down with the most influential leaders and top traders in the industry. Now, here's your host, Anthony Crudele.
Hey everyone, today is a special day for Futures Radio Show as we announce a new sponsor, Top Step Trader. One of the most popular questions we get here at Futures Radio Show is from traders that are looking to get funded. Top Step Trader is the world's most innovative funding opportunity. If you can prove you can profit, show you can manage risk, you can become a funded trader. Now, I have visited their office in Chicago and I've gone through their combine. They are a top-notch service with top-notch people. Be sure to try them out for free at topsteptrader.com. Now on to today's guest. I spoke with a man who, after university, got a job at Dow Jones Telerate and then moved on to work at a stock brokerage firm doing international equity derivatives, futures, and options. He then went on to Goldman Sachs to run a hedge fund sales business, and during his time there, he had the opportunity to speak with some of the most famous traders in the world. After Goldman, he ran a global macro hedge fund, and from there, he started Global Macro Investor Research to help big funds with their trading. After this, he went on to start the financial media company, Real Vision, because he didn't like how the current financial media was treating the industry like entertainment. He is the CEO and founder of the Global Macro Investor and the CEO and founder of Real Vision Group. His name is Raul Powell. Today, Raul and I talked about how time horizon and the broadness of the way he looks at things is his edge. We talked about his reason for being bearish crude oil and why he thinks it will hit $30 or even $20 a barrel. Raul explains why he is bullish the US dollar and how his view on the dollar fits into his overall theme of the markets right now. Finally, Raul explains why he was an early buyer of Bitcoin and why he just recently covered his position in it. I've done 130 interviews on this show, and this was by far one of my favorites. Raul and I have completely different trading styles, but we have a lot of similarities when it comes to using confirmations within our trading. Also, his reasons for starting Real Vision were similar to my reasons for starting Futures Radio Show. I had a blast speaking with Raul. Not only does he have a deep understanding of markets, he's a really great guy. I know you will enjoy hearing from him today. As always, thank you all for listening, and please enjoy this episode. Raul, welcome to the show.
Hey, great to be here, Anthony.
Yeah, it's great to speak with you today. Now, I've been following you on Twitter for some time, and I'm a subscriber to Real Vision, which is fantastic, by the way. A big fan of what you're doing with Real Vision, and I know we're going to talk about that a little bit more in this interview, but before we begin discussing the topics that we have for you today, can you tell us how you got your start in the industry and walk us through your career a little bit? I mean, you've got a big following on Twitter, a big following in Real Vision. I know that I'm very curious to wonder how you got your start, and then talk to us about the reasons why you started the Global Macro Investor and Real Vision.
Sure. So I finished university back in 1990, which was a recession, if you remember. The banking industry was rubbish. But I had, over the latter part of the 80s, been dazzled by the world of barbarians at the gate, liar's poker, and all the 1980s kind of finance stuff. And so I knew I wanted to go into banking. And I couldn't get a job. My university degree wasn't good enough. It was a banking recession. Everyone was laying off jobs. So I actually got a job at Dow Jones Telerate. So Dow Jones Telerate is kind of like Bloomberg. It doesn't exist anymore. It's been absorbed by Reuters, Thomson Reuters. And it's basically, it's all the screens and the charting systems and all of that kind of stuff, news wires. And I started off there as a graduate trainee, and I started off on the technical analysis product. So I started learning about technical analysis. Then I ended up educating people about technical analysis as a way of helping sell the product. And I stayed there for about a year and thought, I really wanted to get in the industry. And I managed to somehow talk my way into a job at a company called James Capel, which was a kind of very prestigious stockbroking firm in the UK that was owned by HSBC, the giant bank. And there I started doing international equity derivatives. So I was basically, but it was mainly stock index futures and stock index options. And I ran that business and I moved the whole team from there with me. I was eventually running the international team. I moved them across to NatWest, which was a large UK bank at the time, which is now part of RBS. And then eventually to Goldman Sachs, where I got approached to join Goldman to run their hedge fund sales business in equities and equity derivatives, which I did for several years, and which was an amazing point for me because I ended up speaking on a daily basis to people like Paul Tudor Jones, Lewis Bacon, Julian Robertson, and kind of all of the famous people of the industry. So it was an incredible place to learn. So that's basically my career.
So what were the reasons to start the Global Macro Investor and Real Vision?
Yeah, so after Goldman, I decided to move to the dark side and run a global macro hedge fund. I got approached by one of my clients, GLG Partners, who at the time were the largest hedge fund group in Europe and then became one of the largest in the world and is now part of Man Group. So I ran a global macro fund for a few years and just decided that the focus on monthly P&L was going to be destructive to the hedge fund industry. And I think we've seen that play out over time. I thought, this is not what I want to do. My time horizons are longer. I have different ways of thinking about the world, and I kind of decided to opt out of the rat race. You know, I'd done reasonably well in my career, and so, but I still wanted to be involved in finance. So I moved to the Mediterranean coast of Spain and started writing The Global Macro Investor. So The Global Macro Investor is essentially a kind of high-end research service for the world's largest hedge funds, family offices, sovereign wealth funds, governments, pension funds, that kind of thing. And it's been an incredibly flattering journey where people just pay me for my thoughts and pay me extremely handsomely for that. And I still write that to this day. It's about 100 pages long a month, and I cover basically everything in the world. And my time horizon tends to be kind of the 6 month to 2 year time horizon, sometimes longer, because I think time horizon is edge. So that's, I think my biggest edge is the time horizon and the broadness of how I look at things.
Okay, so you say that time horizon and the broadness of the way you look at things is your edge. I'm very curious, how did you learn this and then realize this was your edge?
It's because when I was running the hedge fund, and even prior to that when I was at Goldman, I realized that I was very good at seeing things, i.e. be able to map out kind of the probabilities of the future and say, well, if that happens, then this happens. And if that happens, then that happens, which is what global macro investing is all about. It's kind of living in the future. I realized I was particularly good at that, but living over the next 2 months, I found that was noise in compared to the actual trend. Because if you think about economies, we get basically one data point a month. So if you think of it in chart terms, it actually means that we get very little data. So you need to look at extended data sets to be able to draw conclusions. So if you think the economy is weakening, then it will set up a number of trades like buying bonds. Now, the ups and downs you know, the business cycle in the interim are meaningless, or the ups and downs of overpositioning and underpositioning in bond markets are meaningless. But you kind of know the probability of bond yields falling over the course of the next 18 months, if you think the cycle's weakening, is extremely high. So extending your time horizon, lowering the amount of risk that you take, but extending the time horizon allows you to stay in large economic trends where I think the real money's to be made.
Interesting. So one follow-up question to that is, when you say time horizon, does price get you out? So let's just say that you have a long-term time horizon on something that you think will happen. So when you're thinking that way, when you say 6 months or longer to be in something, now that trade can obviously get there a lot quicker because price would get you out, correct?
Yes. I tend to be more interested in price for putting a trade on than taking a trade off. I tend to be more interested in my thesis being wrong when I take a trade off. So I'm not I found I've probably lost more money in stop losses than I have in anything else. So I tend to try and avoid that. Now, sometimes it will cost me, but generally over time, many themes will play out. So I'm more time-driven than I'm stop-driven, but on entry point, I'll be very price-driven. You know, I use my technicals very heavily for that, and then tend to run trend. Because patterns can, you know, develop, they can overlap, they can do things you're not expecting, and you stop yourself out even though you were right. And I found that happens a tremendous amount of time. Stop losses for short-term trading, much more important, very different game.
Great insight. Thanks for sharing that, Raul. Now, I want to talk a little bit about oil. You did a great show on Real Vision discussing oil. Actually included some of our regular guests here on Futures Radio Show, Shy Girl, and you had some info from Sam Adani, creator of hashtag OOTT and tankertrackers.com. And I have to say, I thought that was really good, the way you laid that out on Real Vision. What I liked about it the most was that you had an open mind going into it, and then when you heard from all of the oil experts, you then did your homework, and then you gave a call on where you thought oil would be headed. Now, you said that oil would potentially fall to $30 or even $20, and this was prior to the OPEC meeting, which you also said, kudos for this call, you said that the OPEC meeting is most likely going to be a buy the rumor, sell the fact, and the recent high in oil was $52, and that was on May 25th, the day of the OPEC meeting. So it was buy the rumor, sell the news, and now we're sitting, you know, roughly around $49. And so my question to you is, do you still believe in being bearish oil to $30 or even $20 a barrel now that you've seen the OPEC meeting? And if so, what is your reasoning?
Okay, yes, I do believe that. And here, you'll now understand what I'm talking about when I talk about time horizon and how I approach things. So the first thing I ever do is look at a chart. So I look at a chart of oil, and I'm looking at the monthly chart of oil, how it's butting up against a trend line that it broke down from back in 2015. So I'm looking at that thinking, well, this is a likely place for massive resistance. I look at the price action, the structure of the market, and realize, you know, there's a probability of it turning down. I then feed into my other macro views about the dollar, global demand, that kind of thing. So now it's like, okay, here's something that fits within my investment framework that is understandable in terms of technical analysis. And that will say, okay, Raoul, you need to do some work on it. And that program I put together was essentially showing how I then go about the work about it. So I start then digging into the fundamental analysis, you know, what's going on with the supply and demand of oil. And I found out, and also I saw the other big thing was the speculative positioning was huge. So I thought, okay, this is all increasing to the probability that I'm right and the oil falls from here. So then I need to find out what's really going on. So the supply and demand story, that's when I reached out to people. I start building my own models of looking at what's going on in the supply and demand of oil, and found out that really OPEC was cheating because they were producing oil according to the quota, but they were exporting tons more. In fact, all-time records. I found out that most of the demand was coming just from China, who was putting it in storage. They had more storage than any other nation and more than most nations combined, and it wasn't being consumed. So that tells you, and the stories that their storage is filling up. And so that tells you there is a weaker demand side than people imagine. It's not real demand driven by GDP growth. The supply side of what OPEC is trying to do, they are trying to tell you one thing and do the other. Also note the shale producers who are just ramping up and ramping up and ramping up. So when I start looking at all of those things, take into people's account what people's views are, what people think about OPEC, what they think was going on, I thought, you know what, there's a very limited chance that oil is going up. And if I look at the chart, it gave me a price target of around 30 or maybe 20. How I got to the $20 number is I used the inflation-adjusted oil price going back to 1945. 1954. I used that to ascertain where is the general price of oil inflation adjusted over time, and that's where it would kind of settle around those levels. So that gave me the outer limits of where I thought things could go. 30 seemed reasonable because we'd been there only a while ago, and nothing had really changed within the structure of the oil market. Arguably, it was more bearish. So that's how I approached it. Then it was, you know, how do you enter the trade? Well, it was waiting for the price to back up into the range and butt up against all of that resistance, which it did, which was about $57 at the time. And that's when I first put on the trade for Global Macro Investor and the clients there. And then it was the break of $47, which was an accelerant point. Now, this is where stop losses would have screwed the whole thing up because it then bounced back through over 50, as we talked about, into the OPEC meeting. But the OPEC meeting, everybody, all the longs were holding on to this OPEC meeting for confirmation. They desperately needed OPEC to do something. But the problem is OPEC just did the bare minimum, and they didn't do anything about the amount of exports that they were selling and flooding the market. They did nothing about US production either. So that made me think it was going to be a buy the rumor, sell the fact. I had a kind of, if they had done something different, if they'd said we're going to cut production, further than expected, if we're going to extend the production cuts longer than expected, and we were going to reduce exports, then I would have said, right, I'm wrong. But nothing of my trade thesis was wrong. It was just price action in the interim. So that's kind of the whole story of the oil call. And I still think it plays out over time. We've had the OPEC. We've got nothing really to come. OPEC won't do anything until we get lower prices now. So I think lower prices, the long position has to get liquidated more. And I think oil would gradually fall over time. So I'm currently looking at a break of $48, should bring it down to 44, which will be the next stop. And we'll see this develop. This trade should be kind of an 18-month trade time horizon. But I think, you know, the secular downside of an oil, of a bear market, secular bear market oil, which I think this will be, or is playing out to be, you know, we should see a lot lower prices for longer than oil than most people expect.
Okay, a few questions on that. Number one is, how are you trading this? Are you using futures, options, combination of both? How are you doing it?
Futures.
So when you're using futures, and this is a one question I was thinking about asking you, is how do you handle the rollover scenarios? I mean, you have all of these different months. You're taking a trade for multiple months. So basically, you just take it and you roll into the next contract.
It really depends on what you're looking at. With oil, I just looked at the oil curve, figured out that December 2017 was a good enough part of the curve to get the bulk of part of the move. I didn't have to worry about rolling anything. And I figured that would be the easiest way. So that's basically how I did it. Sometimes I'll roll front month futures. Sometimes I will pick parts on the curve. It all really depends on what's going on.
Gotcha. Okay. So the second part was going back to my question about price getting you out. Let's just say the market dips really hard in the next, I don't know, month or two. And all of a sudden we are at $30, let's call it. And you're looking for, you said, a month that you think that could take 18, a trade that you think that could take 18 months to happen. And let's just say it violates $30. Is it something that you would do? Do you ever take a portion of that position off? Do you look at it and assess, hey, maybe this might be the best?
Yeah,
that's
I guess
my question.
If the bulk of the move has happened faster than you expect, you take the position off, I think, you know, because your thesis has played out. To try and aim for $20 starts to become then greedy, and you're increasing risk of a market reversal. You know, your risk is lowest at this point, it's much higher the further it falls. So I'd be tending to either scale out or just get out and leave the rest to somebody else.
Gotcha. Okay, good to know. So on the flip side, you know, I've learned in this business, the number one thing I need to know where you're wrong before you can be right. My question to you is, where would this trade then turn wrong?
Firstly, I would need to see structural changes in the market. So that would be the key thing. In the supply and demand imbalance, I'd need to see something, either a large increase in demand that was unexpected or a large reduction in supply that was pervasive. Those two things would make me change my view. If not, you see, if I look at the price chart, you know, this could be an ABC correction in the price of oil, and it could have another spurt up to 60. Now, I would probably get out at the kind of recent highs of, you know, 57, 58, 59, where I got into the trade, and then look to reestablish the trade should it roll back down again from a higher level. So, because my thesis is not proved wrong, the price is proved wrong. So, you know, I tend to, you know, if I'm starting to run profits in a position, I tend to use my entry point as a stop. And then I can reassess from there because, you know, I might get another chance to short it again at a higher price, which is fine if I think the trade runs over 18 months.
Okay, great. Now I want to move on and talk about the dollar a little bit. You said that there is a chance of a larger dollar move higher, which for those of you that don't know, that would actually probably help a call for crude to go lower, because typically if the dollar is weaker, crude would go up. If the dollar goes up, crude goes down. It's not always the case, but I'm just mentioning it for maybe some new traders that don't understand that. And you said also a risk of weaker growth in the U.S. for the next few months. And I have to say, talking about your dollar trade, I felt this way about the dollar really towards the end of April. I would have never said that the end of May we'd be where we were after I saw the action at the end of April. But the exact opposite has happened. The dollar has gotten a lot weaker. And I've been tweeting about this a lot, talking about how I believe that the breakdown of the dollar technically is really, I think, one of the biggest stories right now. People talk about equities and treasuries and a lot of other markets, but I think that the breakdown in the dollar, I think, is a big surprise. I don't think people saw it coming. And now we're below, I use an easy gauge, 50, 100, 200-day moving averages. Are we below them? Yes, we're below all of them. And they can't seem to get above them, and we just continue to grind lower, which alerts me of being wary of buying dips. So when I hear you talk about this move with the dollar going higher, it's of great interest to me because I am wondering, okay, what are you seeing that indicates to you that the dollar might start to move higher?
Okay, again, firstly, we need to understand the differences in our time horizons. You know, what is your time horizon versus mine? What do you call, you know, if you say the dollar's breaking down, what are you talking? Is that the entire bull market of the dollar that started about 2011 breaking down? Or are you talking about the recent price action in the last year or so? So okay. First, let's ask your view, and then I'll explain it versus mine.
Okay, so here's what I look at. I use daily charts to determine the primary trend. And I use the 50, 100, and 200-day moving averages to see how we are closing above or below those daily moving averages. Then from there, I take support and resistance levels that I created on a 60-minute chart, and then I execute that strategy on an hourly basis. So I know I want to be more aggressive to the long side if on the daily charts we are above the 50, 100, and 200-day moving averages, for example, S&P, and if we're below the 50, 100, or 200-day moving averages, then I would want to be more aggressive to the sell side and less aggressive to the long side, like we are seeing right now in the dollar.
Yeah, so how I look at this is I'm coming at this as a wildly different time horizon. So I start with a chart from 1967 of the DXY. I then draw a massive wedge pattern using the two previous bull markets, which helped me capture the low, and I was very good with capturing the low in the dollar. I thought it would bounce off that because it looks like it's a downward sloping wedge, which is a potentially extremely positive pattern. Now, so I'm talking about the potential for a much larger dollar bull market than people expect. So that's the outer edge of my trade. So that's like the $20 oil, i.e. the DXY could go much further than anybody ever expected. So then I look at the structure of the trade and where we are. We've never really retested where we broke out from in that giant wedge. So if I move into that closer chart pattern for me, I look at the previous dollar bull markets. This is very similar to many. It would normally run another 2 or 3 years. So therefore, the chances are it should go further. If I look at the previous dollar bull markets, those ran significantly higher. So the first dollar bull market was 100% move. The second one was 50%, and this one's 35% so far. If I look at the structure, then I think it should move another 20 or so percent over time. And that's my minimum price objective. My maximum price objective is something much larger, but we'd have to see. That would be a slightly different world we're in. But there's possibilities and probabilities of us being in a slightly different world. You know, what happens if Japan monetizes its debt and dollar yen goes to 250? All of those things are there and have probabilities, but right now they're relatively small. So for me, when I look at the price action of the DXY, it's basically overlapping into the previous area that it hooked up from the last time it went down back in 2016. Usually I find those kind of areas are where you find key supports. It broke down from a wedge pattern and kind of broken back in within it. So I'm just watching it now. I use DMARC indicators to help me time this. I don't see any reason, structural reason, why I think the price or the trend of the dollar has changed. So I'm now looking at, you know, I would find it unusual should it trade much below 95 from here on the DXY. And it should start to form a base at some point soon. And then I use my framework, my macro framework with this, because it's not just about charts. I won't trade things just off charts. So the macro framework is that the world outside of the US has a carry trade equivalent of $10 trillion. That's people who are borrowing dollars to fund other things. It's the largest trade the world has ever seen, and essentially everybody is short dollars. So again, I'm not talking about the CFTC data of, you know, how many traders are short dollars. I'm talking at a global structural short dollar position because everybody's borrowed dollars. Okay. And so I'm looking at that. I realize how that is a massive kindling should the dollar move higher. I note oil and the price projections of oil. If oil falls, it means there's less dollars available for oil producing countries. So let's say Saudi Arabia at $100 a barrel and they sell, you know, one barrel of oil, they get $100. If oil falls to 50, they get $50. If it falls to 25, they get $25. Now, the point being is their budgets are all in dollars and they've borrowed dollars. So they're incentivized to keep producing oil, which lowers the price of oil, but it also means they have to scramble for dollar funding, which is why emerging markets tend to blow up in dollar bull markets, because people are short dollars for funding purposes. So this is a number of reasons why I look at it this way. So for me, I also note that no dollar bull market in history has ever had a correction on a weekly basis, weekly close basis, larger than 10%. We're only about 5% into this one. We've had several of these in the past. I mean, I've been long the dollar from, or short the euro in another way of looking at it, from 148.5. So frankly, I don't care about the ups and downs right now. But if something moves more than 10%, then that's changed my entire thesis. So there you go, in a nutshell. So it's a very multifaceted, multi-time horizon, both technical and fundamental way of looking at things.
Yeah, no, I love that. And I just want to make sure I'm clear on a couple of things. So right now you believe that if we get below 95, that could cause a little bit of concern in the dollar.
Loss. Yes. Now, okay. I'm just looking at my Bloomberg chart right now. Let me just look at this. I would say larger than 10% correction, that's about 94.5, 93, something like that. From 93, I'm dead wrong. My whole thesis is now finished and the dollar bull market played out. So that would be one way I'd be out. And other than that, I won't change my view. I will add to the view when I start to see it confirm, because I still think the DXY gets to 120 or higher.
I mean, there's really this has major implications if it does follow through with this rally. Like I was saying before, I think that the dollar is the market that everyone needs to be watching. Now, on the upside, how far do you think this could go?
My base case is it depends what happens over the next 2 or 3 years, which will be the end of what should be the bull market in terms of previous bull markets. Now, this structurally could end up being different. It could end up being much, much longer. If I look at the falling wedge pattern, it would suggest this is a multi-decade bull market to come. But I'm not going to make that call. I just observe it and say, okay, just watch that. So I'm more looking for a move to 120, to the previous resistance from the bull market from the early 2000s, late 90s. So I'd say, okay, that would be my minimum price objective. And so that's what I'm looking for, which would be 120. I think there's an outside chance that it goes much higher than that, depending what else happens in the world. You never know with the euro could fall apart. Japan, as I mentioned before, could do other stuff. So I keep an eye on that. So that's basically how I think of the upside.
Gotcha. Now, you mentioned to me that the risk of weaker growth in the U.S. for the next few months is very possible. So how do you see growth playing out over the next year?
My base case, and I use the business cycle, I use the ISM as my framework for the business cycle, which I've done 20 years of work on now. I basically use that. For me, there's a number of things, because we had a very weak period back last year in January, February, March. The data year on year looked a lot better soon after that, and then peters out. So I noted that the economic data should start weakening significantly, which it has. Q1 was pretty weak. Q2 may optically look high, but the data should come in weaker than expected on most counts. Now, the question is what happens for the balance of the year? If the ISM stabilizes, which I think it should do around 52, it's currently, I don't know, 56, 57. If it starts stabilizing at the lower levels and bounces again, then things change. But the US economy is, and that's an indicator for the global economy, but virtually everything correlates to the ISM. Basically, if we see things like oil weakening, oil is a large part of the US manufacturing base now. Now, if oil starts weakening from here significantly, then that's going to weaken the business cycle. If the dollar rises, that's going to weaken the business cycle. If retail, and I'm talking about restaurants, furnishing, car sales, all of these things, if they start continuing to weaken because they're weak, then we could start heading towards a recession. Also, car sales alone, it looks like we're getting ourselves in a big mess with auto sales and massive inventories and maybe a need to shut down production at some point. So what I'm seeing is, I'm calling them the four horsemen. There's four key things there. If those four come together later on in the year, which I think they might. I think there's a reasonable probability, not saying it's the maximum probability, but reasonable, then the US goes straight to recession as and the world follows. We're long overdue a recession in the US. This is the second longest economic expansion in all US economic history. So we've got to be on full alert at any stage right now, and I have been for the last couple of years, and there's been a couple of times where GDP growth has hit zero and bounced again. So those are the things I'm looking at. My guess is if the dollar does move higher, then that's trouble. My guess is if the oil patch suffers, that's trouble. Automotives, I think, are baked in the cake, and I think consumption's baked in the cake from rate rises and other issues. So that's kind of how I see it. I think there's a larger probability than most people imagine that growth is weaker. This is one of the reasons I've been long 10-year bonds on and off for the best part of 10 years now. And there's always been a great trade, and a trade I recently put on again, where I think 10-year bond yields probably come down to, I don't know, 1.8%. And then we'll have a look from there to see whether any of these four horsemen start featuring as a driving factor in the US economy, in which case then there's lots more trades that can be done.
What I find interesting about everything that you're saying, to me, it seems like you're getting confirmation in your research in all of these different markets, and they are supporting some of your ideas and in a completely different market. So we go back to the dollar.
Yeah, no, all the time for me. Everything I do is I look at, I mean, I'm looking at my Bloomberg screens now. I track, you know, 50 different markets, whether it's currencies, bonds, equities, commodities. I look for thematics and patterns that emerge between them versus my framework of the world. And I, you know, my framework's built on technicals and built on the fundamental analysis and understanding of where we are in the world. So it becomes a massive jigsaw puzzle of many, many moving parts. It's a 3D jigsaw puzzle. So at any one stage, you're looking for confirmations or divergences between any of these things. And they could be asset markets or they could be economic indicators.
Yeah, I mean, it speaks so true to me at home with the way that I trade. I mean, like I said, it's amazing because we trade completely different, but yet there's so much similarities, because what I look for is if right now I've been a little bit bearish of the dollar because of some of the things I've been watching. Prior to that, I was bullish of the dollar and I was bearish of 10-year. Now I'm bullish 10-year and a little bit bearish on the dollar because I look to see what's confirming. I'm like, are the technicals proving me? Because I'm a lot more of a technical trader. Are they proving not only in this market that I'm watching, but in the counter market that I believe may do something? Is it proving that as well? And I'm noticing that, and just by hearing you, like you said, it's like this big jigsaw puzzle and you're putting everything together. I find it to be, you know, very, very interesting. I want to talk about Bitcoin. Now, I noticed on Twitter that you said on May 19th, you said that you had the Friday bombshell. I've just sold all my Bitcoin. I'm not bearish, but my reasons to own have diminished. And you said you were going to write this up soon. Now, you were on the Bitcoin trade relatively early. And I just want to pick your brain a little bit. Talk to us about your initial reasons to get into Bitcoin. And I know you're doing a big write-up on Bitcoin, so you don't have to reveal everything what you're talking about in your write-up, but just discuss some of the reasons to recently get out of your position in Bitcoin.
Right, let's talk about why I went to Bitcoin first.
Yeah.
Basically, you know, I've been following this market. I knew very little, limited about it. I understood that it was potentially an answer to the world's currency problems. It was, for me, when I first looked at it, it was like a replacement for gold. It was kind of a digital, you know, safe harbor, safe asset. And that was back in 2013 when I first started, when the price was at 200. And I wrote a research report, which nobody had ever done before, which was a macro view of Bitcoin. And what I basically did is look at the total supply of Bitcoin possible in the future versus the supply that was already above ground, I had been mined. Compared that to the gold market and kind of did some computation and said, listen, if this is like gold, then there is a potential that Bitcoin could be worth $1 million. So I said, listen, the risk reward of this trade at $200 is wildly skewed in my favor. And I said, it's probably the best risk reward I'd ever seen in my life. And it probably was. It was probably one of the best trades I've ever done. I think when I closed out, I'd made between 7.5 and 10 times my money. So it had been, for me, it was the store of value argument. I then started researching more about Bitcoin and spend more time developing it. And I started reaching out to the Bitcoin community. And I realized that blockchain and how useful that was and how this might be the answer for some of the issues in the global financial system, you know, custody, you know, stopping rehypothecation of assets to proof of ownership, where there's some really big and dangerous holes within the global economy and the global financial plumbing. I also saw how it could be very useful for derivative contracts because, you know, when Lehman went bust, nobody knows who owns what. It's a complicated world out there. This was an answer to a number of these things. So I put two and two together and said, listen, this is a new financial system for us. It has incredible benefits. Bitcoin is the only real cryptocurrency that makes any sense because of its scalability and size at the time. And so that was the horse I was going to back. And I thought, I imagined a world where the banking system or disruptors would use the Bitcoin blockchain to start taking on and dismantling the current infrastructure of the banking world. And that cryptocurrency, in particular Bitcoin, would end up being not only just a means of payment, but a store of value because you could never create more of it. It had these finite ways. It was this kind of magical protocol that was sacrosanct. So those were the reasons that I had. And then over the last 3 months, everything started changing. And I've been a huge proponent of Bitcoin. And suddenly I started seeing that obviously the price was exploding higher, but that was against, I saw that all the people involved in Bitcoin, the miners and everybody else, were starting to talk about changing Bitcoin or creating a new one. I thought, well, that doesn't make it a store of value because it's not the safe haven that I first thought it was. Everyone said it can never be touched. Well, they can orphan it, they can change it, they can do all sorts. It's just that they may not do it, but the possibility that they can change it said, okay, that's it. It's not a store of value for me. Then I noted a number of other issues where there were tons of cryptocurrencies coming onto the market. And what I was seeing is that the value of, well, difficult to describe. There's a number of things is people, the financial system was not using Bitcoin blockchain. They loved blockchain, but they didn't need the security of this massive distributed ledger. They needed the security, let's say, of 11 insurance companies or 10 banks getting together and using a blockchain amongst them. So Bitcoin was starting to look like a solution without a problem for the financial system. I saw that Visa, it was supposed to be a disruptor to Visa, but Visa built their own blockchain. It was supposed to be a disruptor to the custody and derivative system, but I noticed I think it was the New York Stock Exchange, the NASDAQ, I also noticed the DTCC, the Clearing Corporation, are all starting to use blockchain technology, but not Bitcoin. And it suddenly it dawned on me that there was a big change and that what we thought was going to be a store of value is not a store of value. What was going to have a killer app was never going to have a killer app because everyone was developing different blockchains for different purposes. And that I think that the world of private blockchains is more likely. And for a much longer thing that I write up in the publication, I talk about why I think most cryptocurrencies and blockchain technology in general are like cloud computing and will be written down to zero.
Wow, very interesting. And I really look forward to reading that. I know you said that comes out on Wednesday. We're recording here on Tuesday. Your show comes out on Thursday. So
It comes out in Real Vision Publications. So if anybody wants to look, you get a free trial. It's realvisionpublications.com. At the same time, Barry Silbert, who's a friend of mine and one of the largest investors in Bitcoin and blockchain technology and cryptocurrencies, is also releasing a piece specifically for us about his view on Ethereum Classic, which is another one of the cryptocurrencies that people have been looking at and have been actively involved in. So it's kind of a very big crypto week in Real Vision.
Now, at the beginning, we kind of went on a different tangent. I never really got to ask you the question, why did you start Real Vision?
Well, if you remember, going back to the story, there was I writing in Spain, global macro investor. I'd obviously been part of the financial system for a long time, and I was one of the people who predicted what was going on in 2008. Now, what was really uncomfortable to me is I had many people coming to me and saying, well, why didn't we know about this? Why didn't my bank tell me? Why didn't the banks tell us? Why didn't the media tell us? And that sat really uncomfortably that some of us at the central financial system knew exactly what was going on and others didn't. And I thought morally, we have a duty to actually look after people. Also, I'd noted that financial media, particularly the television channels like CNBC, Bloomberg and others, were basically treating finance as entertainment. But the reality is it's people's savings. You know, this is what they're going to retire off. This is what they'll pay their kids' education with. It's not entertainment at all. You have to take it seriously. So we thought, you know what, maybe we could just disrupt this whole thing. We also noticed you didn't need a television license anymore. They used to cost hundreds of millions to get yourself a license to broadcast. Now you could just have a video on demand site on the web. You could stream live on the web. We chose video on demand. And we thought, we had known nothing about media whatsoever. We said, look, we're going to do this. So myself, Grant Williams, Remy Tito and Damien Horner, the four founders, ended up starting Real Vision. And we reached out to some of my contacts and Grant's contacts in the industry and said, hey, listen, will you come and appear on this? Because we think we've got an important role within the financial markets. And it's important that people get access to unbiased financial information that's not in sound bites, that's not driven by sponsorship or advertising, that's true. So it's truth in finance, it's long form, it's engaging, and it really helps people understand what's going on. And everyone went, definitely. So from then on, the largest hedge fund managers in the world, the most famous analysts, investment strategists, just came and said, we'd love to appear. We don't pay anybody anything. Everyone just believes in what we're doing, and we've had extraordinary growth from doing it.
Yeah, no, thank you so much for doing it. Full disclosure, everyone, I'm a subscriber, and I highly recommend you check it out, especially with this Bitcoin piece that he's writing out right now. It's a perfect
trial. Yeah, so we have a couple of products. So one is a television side, which is realvision.com. And actually, the price is actually going up next week significantly. So if anybody wants a trial, there's a free trial, definitely take a look because you can lock in the low price. I definitely do that. Also, there's Real Vision Publications, which is written research, which is a fabulous product as well. And that's is where the Bitcoin article is.
Great insight today, Raul. I mean, I loved it.
Also, I think your listeners would, if they enjoy your program, which is fabulous, I think they'd also love our podcast. We've got a podcast called Adventures in Finance. So you can find it on iTunes and everywhere else. And, you know, I'd urge them to listen to that. We do a lot of storytelling around financial markets. We bring on some incredible guests. We do things in a very different way. We're creating something really magical there. And, you know, our audience is growing massively. And I'm sure your guys would very much enjoy it.
No, they absolutely would, because I only listen to a few podcasts, chat with traders, and yours on the trading side are my faves. So once again, now we have some rapid fire questions for you to close this out today. So are you ready for those?
Go for it.
All right, everyone. Our rapid fire segment is sponsored by Trading Technologies. Trade the global markets from virtually anywhere with TT, the world's fastest commercially available futures trading platform. Create your account and try it now free at tryttnow.com. First question, how has your trading evolved over the years?
Much longer term than shorter term. I found that I wasn't a very good short-term trader and stop losses were killing me. Well, my idea horizon was much longer. So I now trade my idea horizon and not the short-term market.
Can you tell us the moment that trading just clicked for you?
Yeah, I had numerous false starts, as everybody does. Early on in my career, you know, I was a broker and I didn't really get it. And then when I started understanding technical analysis and that I could see markets, I'm a very visual person, I could see markets, I understand the structure of markets, it changed everything for me. And then just started to talk to some of the world's most famous investors and the penny dropped.
What's the number one source you spend your time on?
I'm odd. I don't read anybody else's research purposely to keep my own research valuable and unpolluted. So I don't do that. I do watch, I mean, I'm not plugging my own thing, but Real Vision, because there's some really smart people and I get to learn things I would never have known. I do spend a lot of time on Twitter, at Raoul, R-A-O-U-L, G-M-I. So I'm on Twitter all the time. I'm engaging with people. I'm trying to learn. I'm asking questions. I do read some sites like Zero Hedge and a few others, but I generally try to keep it as limited as possible.
What's your favorite book about trading or the markets?
New Market Wizards, without question.
What's your favorite movie or TV show about trading or the markets?
There was nobody will remember this, but one of the things that really got me interested in the whole thing is back in the early 90s, there was a program called Capital City in the UK, which is about being foreign exchange trader and bond traders on a dealing room floor in London, and that just got me smitten by the whole thing.
What's the best piece of advice you've received about trading or the markets?
There's one piece of advice that really stood out. It came from Paul Tudor Jones, who I used to speak to on a very frequent basis and still speak to from time to time. I asked him what makes a great trader, and he said simply, somebody whose idea horizon matches their trade time horizon. What that means is, if you think something is going to move somewhere over the, you know, over the course of, let's say, a year, then don't trade a 1 week view around it. He said markets move within the time horizon that you trade in. You need to understand that. And when you match those things up, and when everybody has different time horizons of which they are comfortable with understanding, once you match those things up, you'll do really well. And I found it was such a crucial piece of advice, changed everything for me.
Now, if you can give a piece of advice to the new people interested in getting involved in trading, what would it be?
Learn how to chart. And I know, again, a lot of people say, oh no, you know, you don't need technical analysis. Technical analysis, even if you don't want to draw chart patterns or anything else, charts tell you everything. They tell you what markets are moving, what's interesting, what's different, what's diverging. So start collating as many charts as you can. Look at stuff you're not supposed to be looking at. If you like trading spoos, start looking at the chart of oil. Start looking at the chart of what's going on in the Indian stock market. Start seeing how the world is interconnected, and you'll see it in price action everywhere. And before you know it, you start developing a framework of understanding of how the world works. Once you have a framework, you can truly trade.
Final question for Raoul today. If you weren't a trader, you'd be doing what?
I'd love to say a rock star, but I can't play guitar to save my life. The other thing I'd love to be is an architect, because I think it has a really rare skill set of being detailed and creative at the same time, but I probably couldn't do that either. So let's go with, I'd set up a media company, which I'm doing as well.
Raoul, I can't tell you how great it was to speak with you today. I really enjoyed this. Thank you so much for coming on Futures Radio Show. Before I let you go, is there anything else you'd like to add to today's show that maybe we missed?
No, not at all. Again, I'm just going to do a shameless plug for Real Vision. I think the podcast, I think that's the first thing people should do. Just go and check out the podcast, Adventures in Finance. I think you'll love it.
Raoul, thank you again for coming on Futures Radio Show today, and I look forward to having more conversations with you again in the future.
Fabulous. I really look forward to answering.
Thank you for listening to Futures Radio Show. If you have any questions or comments for myself or my guests, please visit futuresradioshow.com and sign up to be a premium member for free. If you enjoyed the show, don't forget to leave us a review on iTunes.